All right, next up is David Chambers, PhD. He's a director for Center for Science in Public Participation. He's going to be talking about tailings storage facilities and the long-term environmental, social, and economic implications of caring for these type of facilities. David?
Thank you. So can everybody hear me okay? How about now? Better. Thanks. All of you probably heard of the dam failure at Mount Polley, and that's caused a lot of, hopefully will cause some things to change in the way tailings dams are built and operated. But I want to sort of walk through with you how these dams are built, because they're not built like water supply reservoirs. They're different. There are three basic types of dam construction called upstream method, downstream method, and centerline method. And the downstream method, which is the one in the middle, shaped like a triangle, that's your typical water supply reservoir dam. And those dams are almost always built during one construction period that usually takes a couple of years. Tailings dams are built in segments as the rock that's used for the dam construction becomes available. It's usually waste rock from the mine. So they're usually built a layer at a time, and that's what this layering effect shows. The centerline method, which is the one at the bottom of the page, is essentially your downstream method cut in half. Why can you do that? Because with tailings dam, you actually have a semi-solid, or in some cases a solid, on the upstream side of the dam itself. So that material basically provides some degree of support. In the upstream method, which is the one up on top, the tailings are actually used as a foundation for the lifts of the dam as they're built. Here's a picture of a centerline dam construction with, and remember I was talking about the phased construction. The section up on top would be the first one, second down would have an additional layer of waste rock, and so you can see how that develops. Centerline dam construction, sort of the same sequence from top to bottom, and then upstream construction would look something like this. So why would we want to have three different methods? Why don't we just build them all the same way? So let's look first of all at the upstream method. Why is that used? Well, quite frankly, it's the cheapest way to build these things. Why is it cheapest? Look at the volume of material that you have to move to build it. Smallest amount of material, so less cost to build. But it's also the least safe. Why is that? It's because you're actually using the tailings as a construction foundation for your dam itself. And those tailings start out being saturated because they're delivered to the tailings pond in a slurry. And unlike dry tailings, they're not dewatered, they're not compacted, and they quite often retain a fair amount of water, if not totally saturated, within their interstitial matrices. And that makes them vulnerable not only to static-type failures, which is just sort of like sliding on a banana peel on the ground, but also under earthquakes. I'm sure you've all seen pictures of little sand volcanoes that happened in San Francisco. That material that's saturated and uncompacted actually liquefies. And worldwide, we see most tailings dams failures associated with this upstream type construction. By far, a majority are associated with that type of construction because it is so vulnerable. The downstream method, the one in the middle, is the safest, built like a water supply reservoir, but it's also the most expensive. Again, just due to the amount of material involved. And then the centerline method, not surprisingly, right in between the two. Moderately expensive, but also moderately safe. So why do tailings dams fail, and when do they fail? So the most common causes of a tailings dam failure are, first of all, and these are in order, hydrologic events, that is, big rainstorms. The reservoirs fill up, the dams overtop, and then they fail. Tailings dams typically do not have spillways built into them until they're closed, because you don't want tailings effluent escaping from that dam, and your hydrologic research is supposed to be good enough to be able to predict what the maximum amount of water you would ever see would be. So, and you're also, again, you're incrementally building these things up, and think about trying to design a spillway that would sort of follow that thing up, and it's difficult engineering-wise to do that. So most tailings dams don't have spillways until they're closed. Slope stability failure is the second most prominent cause, and that's basically when the material gets too steep. Think of trying to build a vertical wall out of sand. It just doesn't want to do that. It's got to have an angle associated with it. And if you get the angle too steep, you're going to get, for the material that you're building with, you can get a slope failure. So that's sort of a simple way to think of how slope failures work. And then the third most prominent cause are seismic effects, that is, earthquakes, that will cause failures. There are a number of others below that, but those are the three main causes. When do tailings dams fail? Well, interestingly enough, the most failure-prone time is when the dam is operational, when the mine is operational. Why is that? Probably because when a dam is closed, what you do in a lot of cases is try to dewater it to the maximum extent possible, so you don't have hydraulic effects playing as big a factor. And on closure, the dam at that time sort of has a history of operation, as it were, that's well understood, while during operation, as happened at Mount Pawley, as they were increasing the size of that dam, they ran into a situation that they didn't understand and didn't predict, and it caused a failure. And I'll talk more about that again in a couple minutes. We see a major tailings dam failure about one every 8 months, something like that, worldwide. That's not in the U.S., that's worldwide. So they happen fairly regularly. What happens when they fail? Well, there are environmental costs, that is, aquatic resources can be affected, habitat is destroyed, and when it's destroyed, you get long recovery times for that habitat. There can be social costs, including loss of life, and loss of life is, unfortunately, not uncommon in these failures. And of course, I just called it loss of a sense of place. That is, it changes the local environment. It's never going to be like it was before that accident. And then there are economic costs, loss of business income, say recreational income in an area that had a lot of tourism. And then there's also taxpayer liability for cleanup. I've been doing some research over the last 6 months, and we've been able to, my co-author and I have been able to document seven failures and cleanups post-failure, and in none of those cases has the company paid for all of the cleanup cost, and in most of the cases the public has paid for all of it. So all three of those types of dams that I talked about are vulnerable to failures. Here's an upstream dam, which again I said was the least safe that failed in South Africa. This one was due to overtopping, so the thing filled up, water spilled over the top, eroded out a channel, and then the rest of the water went, taking that big section of tailings with it. Downstream dam, which is the safest type, this one was in Los Frailes, Spain, and there was a failure there too, actually quite similar to the Mount Pauli failure. And then the Mount Pauli dam itself was a centerline dam. And what happened fundamentally at Mount Pauli was they didn't know there was a small glacial lake sitting underneath this dam, clay. And it's kind of like you and I stepping on a banana peel versus your dog stepping on the banana peel. The dog isn't heavy enough to really cause that thing to slide. But when you and I step on it, it slides. And that's what happened at Mount Pauli. They eventually built up enough pressure by building the dam higher and higher and putting the tailings behind it that it slipped and the dam rotated down 3 feet, and that was enough to spill water over the top, and away it went. They, yes, I'm sorry. Did I say feet? 3 meters, yeah. The province of British Columbia convened an expert panel to look at Mount Pauli and to determine what failed and why it failed. And I've sort of given you the basic description of why it failed. That is, there was that glacial lake. There was one significant complicating factor in the failure, and that was that the dam was supposed to be built at a slope like this, but because they didn't have enough waste rock, they were building it at a slope something like that, which put more pressure, again, on the underneath material. And turns out that had it been built according to the original design, it wouldn't have failed. But because that lake was there, because it was being built at a steeper angle, because of lack of building material, it failed. It took both of those things to happen. And then the accident was so bad because that pond was full of water. And when it rotated down 3 meters and let the water spill, that water flushed it flushed a good 20% or so of the tailings out with it. So what did these experts say? First of all, they said the dam should be designed based on safety first, not cost. Now, that may seem obvious, but unfortunately, that's not the way it's done. Cost is usually the driving factor in dam design. And the experts say that needs to be reversed. They recommended no more wet tailings closures. That is, no more tailings dams with water on or near the surface. And they said one of the reasons we see wet closures is because that's probably the best way to prevent acid drainage with material in a tailings pond that's potentially acid generating. You keep it underwater, you deny oxygen to it, and it's a very good way to stop or at least significantly lessen the generation of acid. But what this panel said was, yes, we know that this is a good way to prevent acid drainage post-closure, but given that, we think that if the dam fails, it doesn't matter that you've prevented it up until then. You're going to have it at that point post-failure, so the most important thing is to keep the tailings from being spread out of the dam, to keep them in place. They recommended that a number of best available technology and best available practices be used, like dry tailings, independent review panels for every large dam, more prescriptive regulatory standards, for instance, that would have prevented this steepened angle from happening during operation. And then finally, they said that the panel firmly rejects any notion that business as usual can continue. And of course, regulating these things, and it's the analog, like driving a big oil tanker. It takes a lot of that process has a lot of momentum, and changing that momentum to incorporate different ideas that are going to cost more money, quite frankly, is going to take some doing. So that's it. Very quickly, I'll be glad to answer questions, but I think we're going to wait until all of us have gone. So that's Tailings Dams 101.1. Thank you.
Thank you, David.